for the invitation. And let me just say that I wish very much that I could have come to be there with you. So I really regret that that wasn't possible, but I'm in, this would have been a trip within another trip. Just the risk of missing my flight back and, you know, with possible quarantine and various COVID-related risks, I just had to cut my losses and decided I was going to participate remotely. Let's get into it. I should say I really owe a big... I have to say thanks to many people, but right now, especially John, because his talk was just the perfect setup for this talk. So thank you very much. I will focus on in this beautiful equation that he had there at the end, or near the end of his talk. I will focus on some aspects that he did not get into during the body of his talk, but he mentioned briefly there. And of course, Shubhadeep, who has helped me immensely with preparing the slides for this talk. So thank you also to him. Shubhadeep is not the only collaborator for this work. I list a set of people that have had made contributions to the various pieces that I will be showing. So let me get right into it then. All right. So we live in the age of gravitational wave detections. Maybe for you this is now normal. I still find this amazing. Here's a visual representation of the catalog, let's say, of gravitational wave mergers that we have seen. There is more than one or two. We can no longer count them on the fingers of our hands. So that means we can do statistics, and this bodes well for the future, of course, with future upgrades. So as Jonathan pointed out, here, there's only one confirmed EM counterpart for one of these events. I will be focusing mostly in this talk on what we can do with dark sirens. Jonathan gave a beautiful introduction into the topic. So I will start at a similarly basic level, maybe even more basic than John initially started his presentation. So let's just all imagine that we're in cosmology 101, beginning to learn about cosmology. We learn that the universe is, we learn about the homogeneous and isotropic universe model, Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker. Learn about the evolution equations and so forth. And then as we learn about that, typically chapter 2 in cosmology 101 text, then starts talking about classical cosmological tests. And I remember this when I first read this, one of the prominent ones, something about counts and all the rest of it, but then one of the ones that comes up pretty quickly is the luminosity distance redshift test. So that's the one, of course, we're all interested here. But I remember that when I first heard about it, some part of my brain was confused because we just talked about homogeneous and isotropic universe, right? Okay, so what do they say for the luminosity distance redshift test? I'll tell you what my confusion was later. It'll become apparent maybe. You observe an object's luminosity distance and redshift, and then plot those against each other, and then that function is a function of cosmological parameters of the expansion of your FLRW universe. The thing that just make sense to me was we just said that we were in a homogeneous and isotropic universe. So there are no objects in that. So how can we? How does this work? And so a key point is that we need to consider structure, right? So we can't just talk about the universe as a smooth, unperturbed background, but we, in order to be able to do cosmology, we need there to be structure in the universe, okay? Let's keep going in that direction. So rather than just jumping to saying, okay, let's just imagine that somehow we get objects in this universe and that we can measure redshifts and distances to them. Let's just say, okay, what if there are perturbations around this background? These perturbations fill the universe. And let's say I have traces of these perturbations. So this is the situation that we have with, for example, in galaxy surveys. But let's now consider, and this is the new bit. let's consider two types of traces. Okay, so looking at this really from a cosmologist's point of view, from a large scale structure point of view, we have redshift traces, so things that we can measure redshift to very easily or relatively easily, like galaxies, for example. And we have luminosity distance traces. So I call these SN because one, you know, well-known luminosity distance tracer is supernovas. But of course, gravitational wave mergers, as Jonathan just explained in the famous paper by Schütz, that we'll have occasion to mention again later on. One very good distance tracer, certainly in terms of in just using fundamental physics, is gravitational wave mergers. So when you see SN here, please also think gravitational wave merger. All right, so we have perturbed fields. We have two types of tracers that trace these perturbed fields. So let's write down the simplest possible model for these fields. So let's assume that these perturbations have Gaussian statistics, just for now. In fact, that's not going to be a crucial assumption here. It's just going to be a way to sort of make things more concrete. So for a Gaussian random field, if I write down the spatial statistics now, so something, now we're starting to see something that was not in John's talk, the spatial statistics of a Gaussian random field, where these deltas here, these are the density contrasts, And I'm thinking of them as fields. So every element of these of this vector delta really corresponds to a voxel on the Lie cone. I'm not sure what voxels on the Lie cone are. Maybe loxels. I have no idea. So they're volume elements along the Lie cone. And then this Xi matrix just expresses the spatial. The correlation of the density contrast at different points on the Lie cone. But you see that I've combined the redshift tracer contrast and the luminosity distance tracer contrast into a single vector. And then I've written down this Gaussian, this log likelihood for a Gaussian random field. So this matrix here will have a block structure, and I'll show you that in a minute. Okay, so here's that equation again. So now let's say that we have models for these two different tracers. Let's say that, I mean, they both derive from some, they're going to be clustered, right? We have, as I said, we have perturbations. And so they will each have some correlation function. And let's say that correlation, or the correlation matrix expressing how likely it is that if I see one object, I'll see another object nearby, or if I see an overdensity, more, you know, in the Gaussian framework, an overdensity, then I'll see another overdensity nearby compared to further away. And I will think about these overdensities in sort of a neutral ground between redshift and luminosity distance. Let's say there we're talking about co-moving coordinates, right, which is what your typical n-body simulation, gravitational n-body simulation runs in. Co-moving coordinates are nice because in co-moving coordinates, you can sort of factor out the expansion of space. So let's think of those coordinates as the neutral ground. And then let's think about, but since we're modeling these redshift tracers and these distance tracers, we have to transform from these co-moving coordinates to redshift and to distance. And these, and you can see that these transformations here, do you see my pointer when I move this? I don't know how you can answer me, but I see no vigorous nodding of heads. But
we see the pointer, thank you.
Okay, good, thank you. So these transformation matrices here then move the spatial correlation in co-moving coordinates and sort of project it into redshift space for this Z or Z transformation, and into distance space for the D. Okay, so now we have a model for the joint density distributions traced by redshift and distance traces. Okay, so what are these? Let's look at these transformation matrices a bit more. So when you, for example, for a redshift one, in co-moving coordinates, your co-moving coordinate Z takes that and rescales the redshift coordinates to give you the coordinate system that you measure your galaxies in. Okay, and these coordinate transformations are, of course, cosmology dependent. Okay, and this is where the cosmology dependence comes in. That's why they have an argument theta, and theta is my set of cosmological parameters. So the parameters that determine the expansion history, you know, the rate of expansion over the history of the universe. Okay, and then of course the D matrix is the exactly analogous thing, just for the luminosity distance. And in fact, I mean, okay, without trying to confuse things, but in fact, if you had other kinds of coordinates that you could trace with other kinds of traces, you could just add that in, just extend that vector, put the third set of traces in there, and then you would have a 3x3 covariance. And that, you know, so now that's your homework to think about possible other traces that would be very powerful for doing cosmology. All right. So going back to this, so let's look at these terms and see what they are. If you think about it for a bit, this first, this autocorrelation term between the redshift traces is a generalization of the so-called Alcock-Pachinsky test, and I'll get into what that is exactly. It's a generalization because the Alcock-Pachinsky test is typically considered as a single kind of redshift or around a single centered redshift. And it's basically phrased typically as saying that if you use the wrong cosmology to translate your redshift coordinates to co-moving coordinates, then you won't get the isotropy of your perturbations, which you assumed kind of in the beginning. That's the fundamental assumption that we're making. Here, we're actually talking about the entire data set across all redshift. So it's a generalization in that sense. It's a global version or a light cone version of the Alcock-Pachinsky test. This one there is actually a new test. So by the way, this block matrix first appeared in our paper from 2018. And so I'm pretty certain that at that point, nobody had talked about doing the same thing for luminosity distances. Part of the reason was because at that point, there were very few gravitational wave detections and not that many supernovas, for example. So thinking about them as tracing spatial structure was not really what people did for their living. But over the next decade, we'll have thousands, tens of thousands, and hundreds of thousands of these distance traces. And so actually we can do a different kind of, it's not really the Alcock-Pachinsky test now anymore, I mean, you know, but a test like this in luminosity space. That's quite interesting and hasn't really been returned to and studied in detail. I think there've been other publications, other people have started working on this since then, but I have not followed this up. But it's interesting that you don't have issues like redshift space distortions, for example, in that space. And then there's this off-diagonal thing here, which is also new, or was new at the time, which is a multi-tracer global light cone Akoc-Puczynski test, or again, I'm not sure if you should still call it AP test, but here you're now taking the combination of redshift and distance traces, and you're fitting those together. So that's, you know, since I've said AP a lot, Akoc-Puczynski, let's recall what this is. So cosmological tests typically have to assume something about whatever you're using to test the expansion history with. So if you're if you have an object of known luminosity, then you can just look at how the luminosity varies as a function of distance, and those are called standard candles. If you have an object of known length, then you call it a standard ruler, and you can measure the angular diameter distance to it. And the Akoc-Puczynski test really can be thought of as saying, well, what if I have an object of known shape? So for example, if I know that my object is a sphere, it doesn't have to be an object as such. It can be a, you know, for example, correlations. This is how it's typically done. But if you had a hypothetical object that you knew exactly, whose aspect ratio you knew exactly, you could use it to do a very nice Akoc-Puczynski test, because depending on this mapping of redshift or some other distance coordinate into co-moving space, that standard shape object would appear distorted. And so then you find the right cosmological parameters by making sure that the object gets mapped to its correct shape. So here's what this entails. So you have here's this object, okay? This could be a correlation function. It doesn't have to be a physical object, can be a correlation. And it has some extent in redshift, so along the light cone, so really in time, and it has a transverse extent. And so by combining, basically taking the ratio of those two, you can define this ellipticity parameter. If you do this in the standard case where you do this at a particular redshift, for the true cosmology, you should get an ellipticity parameter of 1. Okay, that's the test. And if you're making the wrong assumption, then objects will appear elliptical that are really spherical. Okay, but as I said, here we're not looking at one particular redshift. Here we're focusing on the entire data set altogether. And I'll illustrate this in the next slides. So this cross-correlation Akoc-Puczynski test, so it sounds very nice, but actually it's interesting because when you think about it a bit more, you can find a limit where it becomes a luminosity distance test, and thereby resolving the knot in my brain when I saw the luminosity distance test for the first time in Cosmology 101. So what you see here is that this multi-tracer AP test involves summing over all pairs of distance and redshift traces. Right? So, and the weights of the pairs of, you know, that are assigned to each one of those pairs in the sum, in this log likelihood that we wrote down, the weights are given by the correlation function. So by the non-zero correlation function, by the finite lag correlation function. That's why you have all the pairs. If you incorrectly assume that there's absolutely no spatial clustering, so the universe is just perturbed by white noise, or for objects that would mean that you just have a purely Poisson distribution of objects, that forces the covariance to be diagonal incorrectly, because we know that there are spatial correlations in our universe, and this double sum, off diagonal pairs go away, and the double sum turns into a single sum, where you have just individual objects that trace both luminosity distance and redshift. Okay, so if you have coincidences in your distance tracer catalog and in your redshift catalog, those are the only ones that survive. So only the objects we have both distances and redshifts to. And that is the luminosity distance redshift test once you fold in the measurement errors. Okay, but that was an incorrect assumption. So in some sense, the luminosity distance redshift test is not giving us everything there is, because we know galaxies are clustered. So we can do this more general thing and use all the pairs. And that will give us better performance without needing to do host identification, because we can use just all the pairs, right? Yes, the contributions from very distant pairs, in the density distribution, very distant pairs aren't very highly correlated, so they're not going to add very much. But, you know, over the correlation length, cosmological correlation lengths, so out to tens of megaparsecs, this will give you contribution. Of course, there are many pairs at larger distances, right? It's true that the nearby pairs have a higher correlation, but there are many, many pairs that simply due to volume effects as you allow for larger and larger finite lag. So we can exploit this in gravitational wave and supernova cosmology. All right, so here's just making this point again. So spatial clustering with galaxies between gravitational wave events and galaxies can be used to measure the redshift. I mean, it's, you know, so I say measure the redshift of the gravitational wave source, but that's really kind of implicit. It's not explicit. You don't have to go and actually measure the individual redshifts, even in the absence of an EM counterpart. This doesn't often get pointed out, but the amazing thing is that Schütz, in his famous 1986 paper, actually had statistical host identification in there. This just uses clustering, but only some, you know, the association of individual objects, as was very nicely explained and demonstrated by Jonathan just now. There is so it's not quite the same thing in terms of, you know, doing this on the light cone and the 3D and writing down all the this problem as a global fitting problem. But if you focus on individual redshift slices, and you don't assume that you don't parameterize these transformation matrices globally, then you can get clustering redshifts, which I think was pointed out first by Auguri in this context. So this paper with Shubhadip shows this generalized light cone AP test. And that was sort of in the first half of the letter, and then talks about a simplified approach, which I will get to in a minute. But let me show you first this how you would actually play this. So if you have your set of luminosity distances from your gravitational wave binaries, dark sirens, so here they are, measured by interferometer. These trace the underlying structure. So I'm showing here simulation. And as you vary the cosmological parameters, let's assume that we're in co-moving space here. And as you vary the cosmological parameters, here they are, H naught, W, so parameters that are relevant for the expansion history. I now vary the positions of these traces with respect to the stuff traced by the redshifts. And eventually, I will find a match. Okay, so then when I found a match, I have my cosmological parameters. Okay, so I'm glossing over the fact that, of course, there are uncertainties in the measurements and so forth that will give you some spread. And also that because I just said that you don't actually need the individual objects to match. You just need to match a gravitational wave, a dark siren, to a clump of other galaxies or the large field, all the correlated galaxies around it. Okay, and that's how you would get the cosmological parameters. And this is a 2D slice, because that was the only thing I could manage to, even with help, manage to plot. Okay. So note that I talked about this as being due to the correlation, because both of those trace the large scale structure. So this might make you feel nervous about using this down to small scales, because if you know anything about cosmology and what people are doing there now, as you go towards smaller scales, it's hard to model this this large scale structure, because you get nonlinear effects that are not well modeled just in terms of the linear perturbation theory. But in fact, this is very kind to us, because gravitational wave sources probably don't just trace the underlying structure, but actually trace the galaxies themselves. So, I mean, in the sense that gravitational wave sources are pretty likely to go off in galaxies. So the way that galaxies are biased with respect to the large-scale structure, the underlying density distribution, the gravitational wave sources are probably biased in a very similar way. And so this approach also includes the host galaxy ID information, because basically this is just if you go to very short correlation distances, right? You can actually do this all the way down to the scale of individual galaxies. So this, I think this has the potential to really extract most of the information that's there, except for another aspect that I will return to in a minute, which can go beyond even what we've talked about now. All right, so in real life, right now especially, the galaxy catalogs that span enough of the sky to be useful for this, because you do need them to be overlap with your gravitational wave detections, are relatively sparse if you have spectroscopic redshifts. And so the photo, so spectroscopic redshifts meaning very precise redshift determinations, but there are often photometric redshifts, photo Zs, available, and they're much broader. And so, and that plus the fact that you don't really know where the gravitational wave sources are in the sky, reduce this clustering information, simply smear it out, either along the line of sight or across the line of sight for these two effects. And so a simplified version, which we talked about here also in this paper, which is quite similar to this clustering redshift, but it's not exactly the same thing, because you're fitting the cross correlations to a model based on the autocorrelations and the bias model. So it's not, whereas in the clustering redshift, you simply look at where the amount of clustering peaks. Let me show you how this works, and then I'll show you some projections and a first application of this, of the simplified approach. Okay, so here's this cross correlation of gravitational wave sources with galaxies, dark sirens, galaxies. So now you take a slice in your luminosity distances and a slice in redshift. So for one slice in luminosity distance, you'll try and see do the angular cross correlation with your redshift slices on the galaxy side, on the redshift tracer side. So you do this for multiple slices, and here this plots the amount of correlation you find. Okay, so you go through, look, there's a lot of correlation, there's very little correlation. Okay, so you then identify the place where there's the maximal correlation, that you can do that then for every single distance slice, and that will identify the optimal cross-correlation slices, the redshift slices, and that gives you what you need to do your cross-model that fixes those two observables, and then you can vary the parameters in this equation to get your cosmology. So if you forecast what this can do with dark sirens, we find that with the simplified techniques, we need about 200 gravitational wave events, but without needing EM counterparts, to reach similar precision to the Schuss measurement on H0. And here's the plot from that paper. And this can be done with any distance tracer, and of course, including dark sirens, which we're talking about here. This doesn't just stop at H0. You can also do, look at the equation of state of dark energy. Here's some projections for the let's see, here we are, for that parameter for a large number of sources. So this is a little bit in the future. Okay, so very recently we put a proof of principle of this application of this on the archive, here using 8 sources from GWTC3. with their each their luminosity distance posteriors, and one of those has a counterpart, right? So, but we're looking at eight sources that that are dark sirens that we can then combine with the neutron star binary later on. Okay, so for final constraint. So here's the, again, you have the luminosity distances, the model for different H-naughts. We split the galaxy catalogs into redshift slices and do this procedure that I just illustrated to build up and basically find these optimal optimal correlation bins and then fit this relation. So here are the catalogs that we're using, the 2MPZ and the Wien Supercosmos surveys. And again, the most complete one has only has photo Zs. And so we are dominated by those photo Z errors for this application. And when you then do this and run your Markov chains, you get a very weak measurement of the Hubble constant. So here's the marginal constraint posterior. But notice that we're also marginalizing over the bias parameters. And so we're because again, in this particular, in the simplified version, the gravitational wave bias with respect to the galaxy population has an impact. And so you need to be very careful and marginalize over that. So here's the result. So the orange curve here is what comes out of this analysis. And then when it's combined with the neutron star merger with EM counterparts, you get this result. So it's at least consistent with what's been found, but without any assumptions about the population model, marginalizing over the bias parameters. The main systematic comes from the photo Z errors, so having to choose a size for the redshift bins. If you choose them too small, then there are correlations between the bins that would have to be taken into account. You would choose them large enough such that these correlations will be negligible. And so, yeah, we get consistent results with this. Just a comment on how these two approaches compare, this full approach that I showed you before versus the simplified approach. The full approach is more powerful because you can, in principle, actually do all of the three things together. You can do the autocorrelations for the luminosity and for the distance and redshift traces and the cross correlation altogether. And that gives you explicit cosmic variance cancellation. So basically then, because you have two different traces of the same underlying field has cosmic variance, but the two traces trace the same field, and so cosmic variance should cancel. And you can see that explicitly when you work out the equations. It's when you're doing the simplified approach of just going redshift bin by redshift bin, you are somewhat, so this is a general problem with the approach of clustering redshifts. If you're just doing this correlation without any further, for example, marginalizing over bias models and so forth, then you're quite sensitive to the evolution of bias, the redshift evolution of bias. Whereas in this 3D approach, even if there's a mild evolution of redshift, since you're fitting across on the entire light cone, it's just basically the amplitude will. Of the most likely point will change, but not, you know, you're not going to suddenly find a spurious maximum in the correlation simply because you have a wild excursion in the bias model, which is probably relatively unlikely as well. But for smooth bias models, then this would be quite robust. And if you're going to this field type approach, right, you started writing down correlated Gaussian random fields in terms of the spatial model, then you can go even beyond that. And that's what I want to spend a little bit of time on now. A complementary approach, so going beyond this Gaussian assumption, I'm not going to have results for this combined thing with distance traces, but let me show you what that would look like just on the large scale structure side, so on the redshift traces side. So the easiest way to do this, believe it or not, even though it's pretty challenging already, we were able to think of, is to start with Gaussian initial conditions in the early universe. We have pretty good confidence that they're at least very close to Gaussian, and then forward model the nonlinear density distribution of the redshift traces today. We have a scheme for doing this, which is called Borg, which is a full Bayesian probabilistic generative model of galaxy surveys starting from initial conditions then fits to a galaxy catalog. You start with a Gaussian prior on the initial conditions, you build a gravity evolution model, and then have a likelihood for the galaxies that describes how the galaxies trace the underlying dark matter distribution at the observed epoch. So this is quite complete now. The first paper appeared almost 10 years ago now, and we have that this has been applied to data, and so it's quite a powerful framework for doing this kind of spatial statistics. In fact, it's really evolved into a probabilistic programming framework for large-scale structure cosmology, with linking, with all kinds of features. So anyway, talk to me later on if that's of interest to you. We then do Markov-Chay Monte Carlo over the initial conditions, so in full 3D. So if you have, that means you have a lot of voxels, a lot of parameters. Every single voxel is a parameter. So you're doing Markov-Chay Monte Carlo in 10 to the 7 dimensions. What comes out of it in the end is you stick in a catalog with observations, you run Borg, and you infer the dark matter densities and actually the full histories of evolution between the initial conditions and the final conditions, which you can then summarize. Okay, so here's an example. This is a snapshot from just a single sample from this algorithm. So here's the Sloan Digital Sky main survey with us sitting here in this corner looking out. These are the galaxies. This is a sample of the redshift zero dark matter distribution underlying this. And this is a sample of the initial conditions at redshift, in a linear regime, that eventually give rise to these galaxy distributions. Of course, because the data are uncertain, this is not a unique reconstruction, but we sample from the force posterior. So I can show you for a different survey, which is related to the one, whoops. Didn't work very well. What's happened there? Let's try this again. Oh, here we go. Can you see this? No. It says it's paused. Ah, it doesn't want to let me show the movie on a different slide. Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to show it. Maybe I'll show it to you at the end of the presentation. Okay.
Ben, can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry for interrupting. You have 15 minutes left.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, so how do you do cosmology with Borg? So actually one thing we found here is that there's tons of statistical power. So doing everything in terms of two-point correlations actually throws away a lot of information rather than the sort of field-based approach. And actually that's a problem because it's really a question of how to make it robust. It's a different regime to where the gravitational wave cosmology is right now. It's there's too much information. And really robustness and systematics are the dominant concern. And so one idea is to decouple the bias model from cosmological parameters. So in other words, let's say we don't completely model how galaxies trace the underlying dark matter, which is important if we're trying to do cosmology only from galaxies. And so what we actually do is we just look at the expansion history. So again, we go back to Akok-Pachinsky, where we keep the parameter dependence not in terms of the distribution of galaxies, the way it's clustering, but we actually fit the parameter dependence only in the coordinate mapping between the simulations, which are in co-moving coordinates, and the galaxies, the observed galaxies, which are in redshift. So that's looking again at this, so only at this first block. But basically what I'm describing here, the reason I'm talking about this is because in principle, you can extend this and then include another set of traces in the luminosity distance block once you have a large catalog of them. So here is this coordinate transformation. Okay, see, this is co-moving space. This is redshift space, and this is cosmology dependent. So you find the right coordinate transformation that makes the distribution isotropic. And this is like a field-based Alcock-Pachinsky test. It doesn't look just at two-point correlations, but actually looks at the full field. So all the higher-order endpoint functions have an effect. And so if you run this on a simulation, again, you get cosmology constraints here. Here are the marginal constraints. Here's the joint constraint. This is for a particular parameterization of the expansion history and for a flat universe. So when you compare this to the standard BEO approaches on the same data set, and so this is for simulated data, but if we did this on the same setup, the simulation matches the setup, this large contour here is what you get from BAO constraints, and that tiny little thing here in the middle is the constraint that you would get from this. So you can see there's an enormous amount of information once you start looking at the field and you include the higher order endpoint function, especially for this highly clustered nonlinear stuff. So they're basically because it allows you to go to much smaller scales. And this is analogous to what we're talking about for the luminosity distance test, because this allows us to combine large and small scale information together and do the cross correlation test, which is even more robust to assumptions. So for this case where it's galaxy only by not getting any constraints from the galaxy distribution itself, like the two-point correlation or three-point correlation, the shape of those, only looking at the effect of the coordinate mapping, this Z matrix that I introduced in the beginning, you can see that all the bias parameters in Borg, modeling the relationship between galaxies and underlying dark matter, basically completely decouple from the cosmological parameters here. But you also notice that there's no H naught here. That's because when you're doing the autocorrelation part, H naught drops out, it cancels out. So just Alcock-Pachinsky cannot give you information on H naught, can give you information on the differential acceleration, but not on the H naught. But the power is that by combining this with luminosity distance traces, you are sensitive to H naught as discussed earlier. Okay, there's another relationship of this to what we're discussing here, which is that since we're actually reconstructing dynamical histories of the evolution of the universe, basically all kinds of initial conditions, all a set of posterior samples of initial conditions that give rise to the galaxies where we observe them on our sky, on our past light cone, we also have all the dynamical variables for all of these galaxies, so for all of these traces. So we can predict the bulk flow of dark matter wherever any galaxies are. In fact, we don't just have necessarily one velocity, but because it's nonlinear, you can have multi-stream regions and so forth. And we have all of this in there. So here I'm showing just the radial component of the predicted bulk velocity field from Borg for a slice. Incidentally, here you see that the well-known structure, this huge Sloan Great Wall, and you can see how material is flowing onto that Great Wall. So you can use this as a nonlinear estimate for the velocity, including, since again this is fully Bayesian, so you actually have the posterior distribution for the velocities, the posterior distribution for the velocity distribution at every single point in your survey volume. And so you can use this if your event is inside the survey volume, you can use this to debias H naught. And so we did this for the neutron star mergers 1708-17, you're all very familiar with this. This is a plot from that paper showing the velocity field in the environment. Of that merger, And this gives you a correction for the H naught posterior. Because these nonlinear methods give you more information in the reconstruction. Okay, how am I doing for time? I have a few minutes left, so I just want to briefly mention other things one can do with EM gravitational wave cross correlations. I think I have about 5 to 10 minutes left.
Left.
Sorry, say that again, please.
At max 10.
At max 10, okay, that's fine. So we have these gravitational wave mergers. I talked about how they relate to redshift tracers, but they relate to the underlying dark matter distribution in more general ways. And so, in particular, they actually probe the mass distribution in the universe, because gravitational waves, at least as far as we understand it from general relativity, are lensed in a perturbed metric when they propagate. And so we can have other traces that trace the lensing mass distribution, and to do, again, cross correlations and learn about the propagation of gravitational waves in perturbed metrics. So in some sense, it's kind of like looking at second order gravity, because gravitational waves are in some sense the force carrier for, not really, so it propagates on if you're thinking about GR in a sort of quantized way, then gravitational wave modes are what propagates, and then those are being deflected again, so it's like a gravitational wave coupling at some level, if you want to go that far. But it's very classical. It's simply the effect of the amplification or de-amplification of the gravitational wave signal due to being lensed by a structure. And so here's the prediction for the convergence for gravitational waves, traced by gravitational waves, and you see that there's this, it's got this kernel integrated with the density contrast that tells you, and this is where the dependence on the density contrast comes from. So one way you can trace all the mass in the universe is by looking at CMB lensing. The CMB photons traverse the entire carry information about the mass projected along the entire past light cone all the way to decoupling, CMB decoupling. This is mostly interesting at high redshift because that correlation peaks around redshift of 2. It's very broad, but the peak is around redshift of 2. And so in these two papers here, Shivadip and Joe and I explored these ideas for gravitational coupling to CMB lensing, but also to galaxy traces and galaxy lensing. To just summarize the results, this is, if you're interested in detecting the lensing of gravitational waves, this is a guaranteed way of detecting lensing of gravitational waves. All you need are enough sources. It's just purely statistical. It doesn't require having luck and seeing a strong lensing magnification. It's just a question of getting enough sources and beating down the error. Slightly updated constraints compared to what's in the paper. Should it just still be, given what we know now, this is likely not going to be able, not possible in the very near term, given the rates, but. On the timescale of a decade or so, we should be able to see this with large signal to noise. So these are the optimistic and pessimistic signal to noise values. But of course, these estimates are somewhat uncertain because we don't know the rates. Okay. Then as a final point, so Shivadip gave me this very nice slide here showing that when you generalize the propagation equations in non-GR theories. Actually, Jonathan also mentioned this briefly at the end of his talk. To include a friction term, then that changes the gravitational wave luminosity compared to what you would see in an EM measuring luminosity distances with using light. And I'm focusing on that because we now know that the propagation speed is basically the speed of light. That's ruled out pretty much all alternatives that predict otherwise. And so this friction term here gives you this factor, which is often parametrized in terms of the sigma naught and n. By forming the right combination simply by looking at looking for the Baran acoustic oscillation angular diameter distance in the galaxy population and measuring the gravitational wave luminosity distance to different redshift slices, and knowing the physical scale of the Baran acoustic oscillations from observations of the cosmic microwave background, give us a way of isolating just this term here and studying those parameters. So let me just finish on an optimistic note. We're all here, I guess, because we're excited about the future for not for gravitational wave cosmology, and in particular gravitational wave and EM cross correlations, where we have, I mean, on the cosmology side, in terms of galaxy catalogs, we are really in a major there's going to be a qualitative change over the next 5 years in terms of the available data, with multiple space observatories and huge ground-based projects, some of which are already underway. So all this will happen very quickly within the next just few years. And then, of course, there's also an exponential growth trajectory on the gravitational wave side. So putting those two together and exploiting those synergies for doing fundamental physics can only be a good thing. All right, so here are my conclusions, and let me finish here.
Thank you, Ben, for the very nice talks. Perfect on time, so time for questions. I see Salva already here.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. So I have a question about the proof from principle study you performed on GWTC, was it 3? Three, thank you. Yeah. Right, so one thing, this may be a bit technical, and it also relates to one of the DS papers that John showed earlier. So you only use, sorry to make you scroll so back far. You only use 8 events, I think it was one of the previous slides, for this analysis, right, or something like that. And I guess that's because these were the best localized. At the same time, as John has shown, in this kind of analysis, it's important to handle selection effects properly. And our selection effects in the LVC are not based on sky localization area. They're based on SNR or force alarm. So how do you know that you're not introducing a bias by using a subset of the detectable events? Thanks.
So I guess one way to address that would be to do the redo the analysis on subsets of these. I mean, if you did leave one out, you could do the analysis of all cases of where you actually reject one of these sources. I mean, there's another aspect of this, which is that you have to have overlap with your galaxy catalogs. So sources that are outside of the galaxy catalogs cannot be considered simply because there's no correlation from them. So that I would say is a benign selection because it's not imposed kind of a posteriori, simply because you know the galaxy survey didn't look there. But you could look at the effect of excluding one. The problem here is that the statistical power of the test is only marginal at best, even at this stage. And so these very reasonable tests that you could do to look at selection effects typically involve splitting your data in some way, and I think that's just not, the data aren't there yet to really warrant that. But I mean, that's definitely something that should be done in the future.
Are there any more questions? There's only question. Please say, just tell them. You can ask them to speak. Mute.
online. I think Ghazal had a question.
Yeah.
Hi, Ben. Good to see you. So in the plot that you put in the inference one, you had a little bump, the second bump. I wonder if you know what is that. Yeah, here. So this is only using the dark sirens.
It just simply says that there's, I mean, these are, there are, you know, obviously at this level, there can be chance correlations, simply, you know, the shape of these posteriors when you're looking at these, you know, these are fractionally like 50% or something like this compared to neighboring points on the posterior. Those can be caused simply by chance correlations that, and so they...
Did you test it with mass catalog?
If you change, this is sensitive to the binning. I mentioned that we decide on the redshift binning that should be relatively conservative in terms of making sure that galaxies don't end up in the wrong redshift bin due to the photo Z errors. But for example, if you have the redshift binning, then you actually get spurious peaks in other places, and actually the overall width of the posterior increases because of that effect. Because the analysis here assumes that the different redshift bins are independent, so we're taking a conservative approach, but there can be residual effects of that nature that that show up there.
This was only observation, but I assume you did mock catalogs too, or did you test it?
Right, so we had this this prediction, but this we did for a much larger number of sources, which which I think was here.
Right. So one other thing is a side note.
John actually illustrated this kind of a general principle for Bayesian statistics that if you're combining posteriors from lots of things together, eventually, you know, if things are set up correctly, eventually a single peak emerges, but you can have all kinds of features, you know, in any one data realization that will because this is data dependent, right? This is for a particular data set.
At some point you want to know it is just that or there is something else.
This is really, this is already, like I said, we're really in the beginning here.
Right. So also a side note, I don't know if you're aware, like a few years ago with Guillaume and Supranta, we did a preliminary run for the Borg forward modeling. It's in his Supranta's PhD thesis, but we never published it because he thought it's not powerful enough yet to do with the other measures. But yeah, I guess from what I understand, you guys are working on expanding Borg to higher redshifts and smaller scales, and that seems to be a very powerful method in future. Okay, thank you.
Okay, for the interest of time, let me last question from Neil.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now.
Yeah, hey, Ben.
Hi, Neil.
So can you just show the corner plot again of the parameter constraints?
This one?
The one showing H naught, I guess.
This is for a prediction. This is for a forecast.
No, so I meant not the forecast, but the one using these eight sources.
Oh, actually, sorry, yes. This one.
Yeah, so just puzzled why you can rule out low H-naught, because you're using eight sources that are found over the whole sky out to gigaparsec distances, right? So therefore, the signal to noise in the cross correlation should be much less than one. And so therefore,
it's basically flat with some small wiggles on it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly. So therefore, I'm just trying to understand why the H-naught posterior also isn't like essentially featureless. Because again, the signal to noise in the cross correlation is much less than one.
Right. Shulip, do you want to comment on that?
Sure.
So here, if you see the cross-correlation signal, for each bin, you have practically much less than one SNR. For the each ATFN, for each bins, you basically see no measurements consistently in the cross-correlation signal in the lowest bin. The lowest bin considers the low H-naught measurements. Because if you see that, so if, Ben, can you go to the previous or the previous plots where you show the luminosity distance plots? That's right, here. This is good enough. So if you see at any fixed luminosity distance, the constraints from on low H-naught comes from the lower values of Z. For all the three bins of luminosity distance, we see consistent correlation signal, which is zero. That kills off the posteriors at the low H, lower regions of H-naught. At the higher regions of H-naught, the constraint there, the measurements will come from slightly higher values of Z. Sorry, let me finish. And there you start seeing some features which contributes to your H-naught posterior.
I think, I didn't quite follow that. So again, the cross-correlation for any of your bins is zero signal to noise, essentially.
Yes.
So if it's zero signal to noise, that means that the posterior should equal the prior. And yet somehow it's not. And so I'm trying to understand how that's mathematically possible.
Right. So there is a plot we show as a function of redshift of how the cross-correlation signal looks for between gravitational sources and galaxies. So here it is not like it is featureless. There is a feature to the distribution which gives rise to this feature in the H-naught value. So this is basically going in the particular regime where you are basically not measuring a correlation signal, but you're going kind of the statistical host identification technique. So if you see our error bars on the value of H-naught, it's very same as what John has shown for LVKO3 for a just catalog part, which is of order of few tens, and also same as Antonina's paper on H-naught, which is of order of few tens, because you are not really getting the clustering signal right now, but you're getting a weightage just because of the number of sources in per redshift bin. So it's kind of in the regime of statistical host identification right now.
Okay, so that doesn't make any sense, but we can talk maybe more afterwards.
Sorry, I don't understand. Yeah, okay, we can take it later because of time. We'll get back at 11:40, plus please write the question in the Google, in the slide deck, and we can take it from there. Thank you very much.